Hi, I'm Richard Edelman. I'm CEO of Edelman, and I'm joined today by Oscar Munoz, former CEO of United Airlines from 2015 to 21. He transformed the company. He also dealt with a substantial personal health issue, major global business challenges, including COVID. He's now on the board of multiple companies. He's a trustee of USC and of Brookings. He's just come out with a book called Turnaround Time in his 6 years at United, how he led that company through a period of transition. So, Oscar, welcome to Trustmakers.
Well, thank you, Richard.
You're really one of the most transformational CEOs I've worked with in my 44-year career. When you took the reins at United, there was a major challenge. In short, a stalled merger with Continental. I remember you had staff showing up with Continental uniforms and Continental wristbands on airplanes. So how did you look at the challenge when you came in, and what was your sort of first set of actions?
Just on your point, the actual terminology on those wristbands and shirts, it said X-Con, just to further drive home the point. And then, of course, the United folks were wearing a lot of the United logo. There had been a brand conversation about which of the two brands, the merger of equals concept, as you and I know, doesn't always or ever really work. And so there was a lot of animosity about that. And as you might imagine, you know, two companies, two cultures, two ways of doing things, two sets of systems, et cetera. So there was a constant pull on one way or the other. The Continental team had largely taken over, to be fair. And so a lot of the Continental procedures and policies were being implemented. And in some cases, probably mistakenly, in the sense that while it worked for the then smaller Continental and where they flew, they did not always apply to the larger scale and global reach that the United network had. So those were the facts and the particulars that on an everyday world, when you're trying to do your job and you're trying to do the things that you're supposed to do, and you have new systems, new policies, new bosses, and there's this constant sort of thread back and forth, it creates some animosity. In addition, the company had had several CEOs on both sides over the previous decade, and that tends to pull people left and right and then left again. And I think probably the most telling story for me when I was announced and I came into the airport and I joined and I was talking to folks, you could see that there was a level of elation and excitement about having not just a new leader, but me. I had written a letter before I joined. It was very different than any letter that they'd seen, because I didn't want to have the normal corporate pavlum saying, I'm Australian, and we're gonna go get it. And so I wanted to show a little bit more of my true, genuine sort of self. So that hit the note the right way. But there was something, Richard, about when I would meet people and we would take pictures, you know, hug each other and all the normal sort of salutary things. There was always a little bit of lingering and a little bit of a look in the face that just told me that there was something amiss, you know, not trying to be overly dramatic, but it was kind of like this, help me, you know, help us. And I could sense that. And that was my first sense that despite the obvious financial, operational, and customer relations issues that the company was having, that maybe the issue was more profound and deeper than that. And the words I used in an article, one of the first interviews I gave, was I found the team disengaged, disillusioned, and disenfranchised. And that as a board member, I was a bit embarrassed that we hadn't seen some of that while I was sitting on the board.
So, Oscar, I remember one of your first acts was to do a full-page ad in major business newspapers in which you, in a sense, committed to your customers that you were going to do a better job, that you were going to have a different kind of relationship, and that the merger would actually be a dream come true as opposed to the nightmare. That was a pretty bold move.
And you know the move well. The quick backstory on this is as a fresh new CEO, I knew I didn't have a plan. And I sought help and I cold called the Chicago Edelman office and literally got an assistant. And I said, hi, I'm Oscar Williams. I'm the new guy at United. I would like to talk to someone in charge. Richard and I did not know each other, but his team came through magically with many an idea. And one of them was an extension of the letter I had written to my own employees about how do we go out live and let the world know that there was a new direction ahead. But importantly, and as you say, Richard, it was bold because it wasn't a speech or it wasn't an op-ed. It was a full-page ad. Nobody was going to believe that this was going to happen. And so putting it out there was not entirely highly supported by a lot of folks, including my own management team and board. And we had a little splaining to do with folks, but it turned out to be the right thing. It got a lot of attention. This guy will never do it. Yeah, we've heard this crap before. They're so far behind, it'll never work. And well, it sounds good. They should be spending their money on something smarter and wiser. But you know, to your team and your good credit, Richard, it was the right thing to do because it began to set a tone and a pace and a direction that was my own premise of proof, not promise. So while at this point it was promise, it set the company forward on there was an objective for everyone to see.
So Oscar, one of the most profound discussions you and I had was quite early in your tenure as CEO, where you said, I have to set a new relationship with labor. I need them to trust management. I need them to believe that, in fact, they can make a better living, but the deal has to be that they're going to deliver outstanding service every day. And you can get a better customer mix and all these things if you can deliver on that promise. That was a pretty gutsy move because your predecessors, each one of them had a very contentious relationship with labor and was trying to squeeze labor costs down. You had the opposite approach. How did you understand that, in fact, this relationship between management and labor was the foundation for improving your strategy?
We all have our formative years in our lives and in our work lives. And my experience, most notably in my previous role at CSX as CFO, then COO, and then president, was running a very large disaggregated union workforce, which had felt and been managed very similar to many companies where it was fear and threats and an overabundance of rules that if you didn't follow them were followed by punishment. And when I took over as COO at this my former company, CSX, my instinct, I think to my heritage and how I was raised was, you know, people aren't angry for just no reason. And yes, union people may be whatever people like to say about them, but I know them to be human because, you know, my dad was a union meat cutter. My uncle was the head of the IBEW union. So in my life, I had seen the other side. And I knew my dad and I knew my uncle. They were normal humans trying to make a life for themselves. So that was kind of my impetus and desire to connect. And at CSX, I had a great experience with putting down safety rules and doing all things we needed to do while closing contracts and improving operations. So as I got engaged more in the union issues, and there were many, I don't think there was any contract signed. And it had been, you know, since the merger, in some cases, you know, 5 years or more with a contract not being signed, which means compensation, of course, for these people hadn't been increased. And there was all sorts of work rules where a United pilot or flight attendant couldn't fly on the same aircraft with a flight attendant from Subcontinental or whatever, and which was just trying to run a business with two different kinds of aircraft and two different kinds of crews that don't match was just awful. So the situation was hard. And so that was the instinct, Richard, is like, I need to go find out exactly what it is for them before I try to fix it. It's a concept that I've learned to dub the listen, learn from that listening, and only then can you lead. And that initiated a lot of conversations that I had with people all around the system at the frontline level.
And in your book, you actually go through one of those conversations in a hangar in Houston, where a baggage guy said, you're lying, and he got quite confrontational, and you didn't exactly back off. I guess, you know, you're pretty brave. And you kind of said, listen, pal, I just want you to listen, and I want to listen to you. I mean, let's have a conversation. And he backed off.
There was a level of me wanting to help them understand that I indeed understood. And what I needed to hear, rather than the, you know, get out of here, we hate you, we don't want to listen to you, we've heard this crap before, or things like, you need to fire everyone. I needed to hear something actionable. It's like, tell me exactly what it is that is the issue here. It wasn't courage, other than I wanted an answer. And yelling and screaming at me wasn't really going to get there. And so that was the situation. But yeah, it was a rather dramatic setting in a hangar with all our maintenance folks who, they fix planes for a living. They don't care about anything else other than, hey, we want to make your flying safe. And we want to do these things expeditiously to get people back in the air. That's all we want to do. Give us the tools, give us the process. You know what? Give us a little dignity and a little respect and we'll get the job done is in essence what the answer was to my question.
And Oscar, how much of this ability to deal with labor stems from your own origins? Your family was not wealthy, and you didn't go to Ivy League. And And yet you got yourself to USC and then on to B school and on to a great career to wind up as a CEO. But you started in a humble way.
The immigrant stories that we all hear in America, there's a sort of through line through all of them. And there's a desire and a willingness and a passion to make things work for yourself and your family, mostly because you don't have a lot of options. I was born in Mexico, left with my grandmother for some time, never knew my father, traveled to this country without any documents, just kind of came across the border with my uncle who was living here. Yes, that upbringing, my awareness, my involvement, my engagement, my broader family members, their lifestyles, there's just something about the fact that everyone I grew up with were just really hard workers to provide for their families. And that's all I ever saw. Work was real work. People got up early, construction. My dad was a meat cutter. But it was the kind of work that I grew up with. So I was not unclear. I was not unaware. And I was incredibly understanding of people that wanted to do hard work. And when you got to the bottom line and asked them what they wanted, it was things around dignity and respect. Don't treat us like animals. My heritage, my upbringing certainly provided me a lot of empathy for this. And I think my heritage, the way I look, my last name, my ability to speak a couple different languages, I think was helpful when I was in those rooms, because try as they might, it was hard to say, you're like everybody else. Not, it wasn't the way I sounded. It wasn't the way I looked, but it was certainly the way I talked, because it was an empathetic, I really do want to hear from you. And I was able to engage people in a genuine way they created. And yes, that comes from our formative training in life from my family.
Only a few weeks into your CEO tenure, you were out for a 5-mile run on Lake Michigan, and you're quite a fit guy, and you get back to the apartment and you have a heart attack. And you were fortunate enough to get to the phone and get to 911, and they picked you up and, you know, took you into Northwestern Hospital, and, you know, they treated you. But you had the presence of mind to pass control to Bret Hart, your chief counsel and now president of United. Tell me that whole experience.
The quick PSA, if I might, on heart disease being the biggest killer in America is probably one of the more important things that your listeners should pay, if nothing else, attention to. Largest killer. Symptoms are many and varied. And so please know that whenever you might feel something weird that's not normal to what you normally feel, it could indeed be something possible with your heart attack. And the advice I got from a good friend and doctor says, you know, if you ever feel anything weird, call 911. The worst you can be is embarrassed that it's indigestion or something. And I crawled to the landline, not my cell phone, and immediately called 911 and told them where I was. 37 minutes later, I was on life support, artificial heart and lung machine, and on a medically induced coma. Did I have an extra couple minutes? Maybe, or maybe not. But the timing of it couldn't have been more perfect. And it led to a heart transplant, which is a whole other conversation about someone telling you they've got to replace such a vital organ, and which I had no interest in doing, but inevitably did. And what transpired through the whole thing is a couple of things. One, the outreach from my United family through their letters and cards and flowers and food that they would send to my apartment was plentiful. And what's poignant about that is that it was 37 days into the job. I wasn't their long-term CEO. So the conversations that I had, the one that we discussed in the hangar and many, many others, that's a leadership lesson. When you connect with people in a large organization, your best megaphone is an individual you talk to that tells his or her friends and vice versa and following through. And so I had a ratification of the pride and professionalism and the love and desire to care for others that the company had. And it made me stronger. I recovered quicker and I was ready to get back to work. Alas, I wasn't quite physically ready to go because I needed to go through this heart transplant. And that's another story of how eventually that came to be. But the transplant came on my birthday. On the morning of my birthday, the call came. And to quote my doctor, Dr. Anderson, he said, "Have we got a kick-ass heart for you?" And it's like, "Yes, sir, let's do it."
When you came back, and I remember the lunch we had at the restaurant on Michigan Avenue, we were sitting down and we were talking about how you wanted to have a new rallying cry for the airline. And we sketched on a little napkin the new spirit of United. And you stuffed it in your pocket and you thought about it for a couple of days and you called me up and said, "That's what we're going with and I'm putting it on the airplanes." Because trust in a way is built inside out. And if you had a new spirit with your employees, you could communicate that. Tell that thinking process.
interestingly, in aviation history, this paper napkin concept appears to be a reality. I think Southwest and Herb Kelleher, when he started that airline, I think he drew on a napkin, Houston, San Antonio, and Dallas, and that's how Southwest got started. I've heard the same story about Virgin Atlantic, of how somebody presented him with this big plan, and he says, hey, if you can't put it on a napkin, it's not a good plan. And so the conversation you and I and our teams had was we were beginning to get traction. I was back. We were building a team. Things were beginning to go well. I had coined the phrase, we're quickly moving from people saying, oh, what's wrong with United, to kind of a more positive, hey, what's next for United? And so we were beginning that in that premise, and we needed to kind of promote it from within, to your point. And we weren't talking about a tagline. We weren't talking about advertising or anything. We just needed a phraseology. And as we discussed over the course of that evening and eventually sketched on a napkin, was this concept of the new spirit of United. And it gave me such a wonderful platform, because as we put it on our planes, as we talked about it, as I mentioned it in my speeches, it gave this company that heretofore had not had a driving mission necessarily or a forward path, it began to have a nice little feeling of a purpose.
So, Oscar, about 4 years ago, there was a incident on the flight between Chicago and Louisville where the flight was fully booked. You had to get two pilots down to Louisville to have pilots for the next morning for an outbound. And you went to the normal thesis of asking passengers to come off the plane. Nobody would. And then you did a computer system play to say, okay, well, the guy who resisted was eventually taken off the plane by force, leading to, you know, a viral video and outcry, et cetera. Do you want to just walk back and tell us your sequence of events, how you thought about the public outcry and how you managed it?
A lot of people like, oh, you know, you don't really want to talk about that. And I always say, I absolutely want to talk about it. If you don't hear the heart story, PSA, you should understand this one, because all of us at some point in time in our life will face crucial decisions like this that mean a lot to a lot of people, including yourself, obviously. So here's the sequence of events and the mistakes and why we made the mistakes. And then I think the solutions. The first thing is the facts. The facts were that it was a United Express aircraft and United Express company and pilots and systems that forced all this to happen. We had a conversation with the fact that the mistreatment, the dragging, and in essence, beating of that customer was the Chicago Police Authority, not a United employee. And we had this mixture of facts and data that said we followed our procedures. And so my initial response was mostly to defend our policies and our employees who were sort of immediately attacked. The thing that we learned first was, and most of us won't even recognize the fact that in 2017, Twitter and social media was still in its relative infancy. We've done the research, and I can't categorically say this, but we may have been the first large global company to get hit with something of a negative viral video like this, because what I said in response was a term reaccommodated, which was trying to replace the word overbooked, which one of the staff members had used early in the day. We didn't want to use overbooked because that's a regulatory hot button. So the word reaccommodated came into play, and that went out on this vehicle called Twitter. That got out incredibly quickly. And all of you have seen the video. And I think my first regret is I should have had us, the whole team, watch that video until we grew sick to our stomachs, because then we would have never used that word. So huge mistake on my part. The backlash is growing. The doctor, Dr. Dow, says he's Chinese. He was Vietnamese, but nevertheless, China writ large hears this. And I've heard rumors of 400 to up to 800 million views of that video. And of course, in a world of anti-American sentiment in a country like China, you can imagine how incredibly and globally infamous I became overnight. And so big drama, big situation. Again, turning to my friend Richard and his firm, what do we do? How do we do this? And the idea was to get to live TV, a Good Morning America, as I think the one we chose. And then the preparation for that was difficult, because do we try to tell the facts as we know them? Meaning it wasn't United. Quickly, we came to the issue of that something more profound had to be said. And for me personally, in the middle of that night before that morning, I dropped to my knees and looked upwards. Not that I'm a pious person by any means, but you know, it's like my company, our brand, to a degree, my heritage, everything was surrounding this issue. And you kind of had to get it right. You know, when they say it's lonely at the top or the buck stops here, you'll eventually, most of you will feel this at some point in time. It's a daunting feeling. But my memories went back to my upbringing when I was growing up in Mexico with my grandmother and my maternal grandmother, who was the most incredible human that you had ever met, hardworking, never complaining, worked till she was 86 and just had all these maladies and physical ailments that she never once complained about. And all of that came rushing back to me. And so when I got on TV the next morning, not exactly knowing what I was going to say, but the decision was I was just going to own it. And when confronted with a kind of, how can you let this happen? And I forget the exact words that she used. My answer was simply, it was horrific. And I let the policies and procedures of this industry get in the way of doing the right thing for a human being. And here's what we're going to do to rectify it. So take it directly and own it, and then promise to fix it very quickly. It was unsettling to the media because they were looking for a CEO to start pointing the fingers. And then, of course, my staff was looking for a more carefully worded protective argument. But when I just took it on myself, there was audible gasps on both sides. It's like, hey, he wasn't supposed to say that. It's like, all right, how do you follow up when someone says, you're right, I was wrong, and it's my fault, and we're going to fix it? The lesson lies there is that it's never too late to do the right thing or say the right thing. And I think that's process. So there was a lot of initial backlash and communication. But again, what else can you say? He said it's his fault and they're going to do these things to fix it. And the conversation is over. And all that was left, you know, the proof behind the promise of making things better at United.
And I remember that you came back within a few weeks and said, we'll pay $10,000 for someone to lose his or her seat and we'll have baggage go for free. And, you know, things like this that were substantive changes. And that was very popular when you went down to the congressional hearing because they wanted to crucify you. And you were really quite, look, I'm changing these processes. I'm the change person and I take responsibility. And that was pretty smart. So Oscar, the pandemic, March 2020, let's go back to that time when air travel basically stopped. And you still had a lot of people on payroll. The government was negotiating to give you money as an interim period. Can you take us back to that time and then how you kept people still thinking about the airline and then the return to travel, which happened slower than any of us would have liked?
What we were trying as an industry to project is economic vitality and commerce in our country is centered on many things. But commercial flying is absolutely one of them. And forget the big businesses and, you know, the job that your team does, Richard, and the consultants and the lawyers and all those that do big deals. There's millions of small businesses that couldn't and can't sit still in their home and work from home. They've got to get out. They've got to travel and visit. Because it's their existence and livelihood. So the math was we lost 93% of our revenue. Some $50 billion that we generated the previous year, 93% was gone in 2 weeks, zero. And the only remaining revenue was we were trying to fly, you know, medical personnel and goods and stuff from and medicine. But all our people were still there and all our people were still being paid. So the suggestion was we needed government assistance to maintain those people, keep them paid through this period so that we could recover very quickly. It quickly became in the press, oh, yeah, there's the airlines looking for another bailout or a handout. And I have to correct that. The industry had never been in its history in a more positive stance than early of 2020. United had just delivered on a three-year plan, 1 year early. We had the plan put together for our subsequent 3 years, large aircraft orders. We were on a roll and the industry was not far behind in that regard. So when somebody uses the term bailout, similar to the auto crisis, it is just completely wrong. That was point A. Point B, that the way an airline works, you cannot let people go and then tomorrow call them back. Pilots need to keep constantly trained on the aircraft they fly for safety, which I think everyone will agree. We laid out the plan as to if we want commerce to return and return quickly, You can't have all the US-based airlines lying dormant because you're never going to get anybody off the ground. And through a lot of negotiating, a lot of conversations on both sides of the aisle, all hours and day and night, I have probably had my best civics lesson in the world and probably interacted with every single leader of every single committee, along with my colleagues in the industry, to inevitably get to this $50 billion structure, which again, was not a bailout because it was loans and loans with a lot of attachments. To this very day, airline executives are not getting paid more than a certain amount. There's a cap on compensation. There's limits on share repurchases and so on and so forth. So the industry had to wait its time and the executives had to wait their time for compensation. But it did allow us to maintain our mobility and agility to bounce back fairly quickly. And it's been spotty. We've had the issues. Last summer was one of them. Not everybody's at the same level of recovery, but you can imagine how much worse it would have been if we had let everybody go. We would have had to build these airlines back from scratch.
So, Oscar, at the end of 2021, you passed the baton to Scott Kirby. You've gone on to a next phase for yourself, which is to be on boards, but also to be a major supporter of Latinos in business. Do you want to talk a little bit about this venture?
It's a nice phase of your life and career where you're now unshackled from the burden of anything you say when you represent a brand like United, it immediately gets tied together. Anything I would say, well, United said that, and that's not the case. This is a nice opportunity, given the success that we've had, given the relationships I've built, both in business and politics, to be able to thoughtfully and articulate and educate, I think, America on the value of the Latino cohort in America. Not because we need more or want more, you need to hire us, that it's a growing economic force. It is an incredibly digitally native and brand loyal business cohort, and it's increasingly more affluent, more educated. People are voting more, and they're not all Democratic, as we've learned very quickly. They're just part of the culture and base of this America. And increasingly, they're younger. We talk about millennials, Gen Z, Gen X. Guess who makes up a lot of that portion? So it is your next marketplace, is what we tell capital allocators, CEOs of the world. And so our approach is not to force you to do anything other than, can you listen to this stuff, this information, this education? The Latino population, by measurement of GDP at $2.8 trillion, that's the economic output and vitality of this cohort in America. It makes it the fifth largest nation in the world. Here in the U.S., we all segment in business. And why would you not pick this segment as a viable one and begin to promote and advertise into it, is what we really like to say.
So, Oscar, we're in a time in America where business has been embroiled in political issues. How do you advise CEOs to deal in this very heated environment?
Yeah, boy, that's a tough one. And it's the world you live in, Richard, and you provide a lot of this advice to folks. And I think there is no specific template. What I advise on, after learning more facts, is as much as possible, I tell the stories of my situations around this. We had a situation around immigration where the Trump administration was separating children from their parents at the border and using the United contract to take those children to the detention camps. That's a political hot wire, directly with the federal government, directly with the president of the United States. It's a massive, as you might imagine, contract for the company that I made a quick decision to cease. Yeah, we're not going to honor that contract if you're going to separate children from their parents. And the premise behind that for me was twofold. It wasn't personal, because it's immigration and it's people coming from the southern border and I am Mexican. It's like, oh, well, clearly that's why he's doing it. It had really nothing to do with that. It had to do mostly with a very inhumane and human issue of who would want to separate parents from their kids. There's a time and place that we know in our history, started World War II, where people were being separated that way. So I tell that story a little bit for dramatic efforts, but whatever you take on as a CEO, whatever issue there is, you have to have an understanding, a deep resonance and conviction about what you're doing and why, because it's going to be held in the harsh light of day. And it can't be you're just trying to make news or you're just trying to poke somebody in the ear with these things. And so silence is deafening in today's world. You cannot say anything. So I tell CEOs to be prepared. Whatever social issues out there, you should have a response because you're going to be asked. You're going to be in a conversation like this, and they're going to ask you about any one of those things. If you stutter, if you fall, or you say the wrong thing, then all of a sudden you're embroiled in a situation you had nothing to do with it. But mostly, for me, it's always about make the story feel like you've made a decision based on your own ideals and principles, not your biases, not your viewpoints, but ideals and principles. And that separating children from their parents was mine in that particular case. And then CEOs have to really, you know, find themselves in a tough situation of how they're going to approach this.
Oscar, let me just wrap up our conversation with the observation that trust drives growth and action drives trust. And in that last discussion, you said, I chose to not continue with that contract. That was an action that enabled trust, and all your stakeholders could then appreciate you as a CEO with conviction and values, because that's really the new mode of leadership. So, Oscar, I just want to thank you for being on Trustmakers and to say that I'm looking for more great things from you in the next decade, whichever way your career progresses.
Well, thank you very much, and I look forward to certainly our continuing friendship.
Thank you for tuning into the Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.